the polarization now that we're seeing is real open fascism at the levels of running the government, and a fascist base that is much more energized, armed, and dangerous.
Welcome to episode 31 of Inside Without Now, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of this show. In today's episode, we are sharing an excerpt of What Just Happened, Trump, America, and the Danger of Fascism, a virtual forum that took place on November 24th and was hosted by Refuse Fascism and the RNL Show. You will hear from Andy Z, host of the RNL Show and co-initiator of Refuse Fascism, Coco Das, editor of refusefascism.org, Indy Samarajiva, a writer based in Colombo, Sri Lanka, who authored a provocative essay titled, "I Lived Through a Stupid Coup. America is Having One Now. You've Already Lost. This is What Americans Need to Understand." And Jeff Charlotte, author of This Brilliant Darkness and The Family. They explore the following questions. For the last 4 years, have we been dealing with just the most reactionary and corrupt Republican administration in U.S. history? Will things just go back to normal? Or are we dealing with something different? A fascist regime which cohered a virulent, hardcore fascist movement that is not just going away. What are the implications for the future? After that, I'll share a conversation I had with Deborah Sweet on the 50th anniversary of her confronting Richard Nixon on his war crimes.
Good evening, everybody. I want to welcome you all to the forum, What Just Happened? Trump, America, and the Danger of Fascism. I'm going to begin with some opening remarks, and then you're going to hear from three people who have been spending a lot of time studying, writing, and speaking about this topic in very thought-provoking ways. Their leader is still in power and waging an all-out battle to overthrow the election he clearly lost. His followers maraud through the streets and raise $2 million for a teenage killer's bail. They destroy Black Lives Matter murals and chant, "Say his name, Donald Trump," spitting on the anguished cries of Black people whose lives are so routinely cut down by police in this country. And they don't, for the most part, wave swastikas around and salute Hitler. But we have a Nazi problem in this country as deeply as the German people had a Nazi problem in the 1930s. Their minds waterlogged with conspiracy theories. They take lies as truth, spread hate and bigotry. They wrap themselves in several flags, the American, Confederate, and Blue Lives Matter flags, and use the Bible as a weapon of violence and repression. They are a grotesque expression of the worst of this country, of its ugly narcissism, its thuggish militarism, its ignorance and refusal to give a shit about the rest of the world. They carry the torch of slavery, genocide, and Jim Crow terror. Gunned up and maskless, they exalt above all the right to kill. Trump lost the election. They lost. We poured into the streets to celebrate, but they will not go quietly into the night. Fascists have and can come back from defeat, and when they do, they are stronger, more prepared, and more filled with vengeance. With his unhinged audacity, Trump still dominates the airwaves, turning an election that was decisive into a debate. Every day that he remains in power is an unrelenting barrage of lunacy. Every day is another day of the unthinkable and unprecedented, said out loud and acted upon. Every day is 1,000 more deaths from COVID. And the humanity and the morality of a portion of these 73 million people is so hollowed out that they cannot even mourn the dead. And what about the rest of us, who did not want this, but learned to live with it? having Trump's hands off the levers of power will be a great thing for humanity. But if we had flooded the streets in nonviolent protest and demanded the regime must go, could we have prevented the deaths of 250,000 people, the detention of 500,000 immigrant children over 3 years? We don't yet have a full accounting of the lives that have been lost and destroyed under this regime, from the Muslim ban, family separation, environmental protections overturned, civilians killed from US bombings without even lip service about collateral damage, and unleashed white supremacist terror. And we don't know yet what will happen over the next 2 months. But we do know that it won't be soon enough that Trump and Pence leave the White House, and they, their movement, must never be allowed to come back. Our first speaker will be Indy Samarajiva. Indy is the author of an essay that was all over the internet this past weekend called "I Lived Through a Stupid Coup. America is Having One Now. You've Already Lost. This is What Americans Need to Understand." We're going to hear first from Indy and then from Jeff Charlotte, professor of English at Dartmouth College and author of The Family and This Brilliant Darkness. And then we're going to hear host of the Revolution Nothing Less show and co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org and spokesperson for Revolution Books. So we're going to hear from Indy first, all the way from Colombo, Sri Lanka.
Thank you for having me. And I'd also like to thank Refuse Fascism for making a pledge to humanity and to the world, because we are watching what's happening in America and we're like, WTF. It's quite, and it's not just that like, oh, we're watching this dumpster fire over there. This fire is heating up our air. I would say in Sri Lanka, one of our major issues is climate change. Within my daughter's lifetime, all the beaches I know could be gone. And while America is fascist, we cannot face this existential threat to all of our existence. So while I think it is very important for you to march and to resist this, I would also like you to remember that you're not necessarily marching for us, but you're marching with us. And people of the world, who I'm not like the UN Secretary General or whatever, I'm just a person who lives in the world. But people who live in the world, your immigrants, just people you know, we have a lot to offer you and a lot that can help you in your struggle. I think your struggle against oppression is also our struggle, and I think this requires international solidarity. So as to the question at hand, you're asking what happened in America. And I think that's much easier to understand if you understand when. I grew up in America. I grew up, you know, pledging allegiance to the flag. And I grew up thinking that America is 225 years old. But if you look at it by any objective standard, American democracy is only 60 years old. And your founders are black people. They're not those white people, which was only the 6% of the population that could vote at the time. Almost every country in the world defines modern democracy. I don't mean Greek, Roman, slave democracy. Modern democracy, we define that as one person, one vote. And you didn't get that until 1965. And, you know, Rosa Parks is more your founding mother than Thomas Jefferson. One thing that perspective can give you is the fact that you're a young democracy, and older democracies like Sri Lanka or, say, Germany have gone through some of the shit you're going through now, and we have lessons which might be relevant to you, which can save you a lot of pain. I know American exceptionalism makes most Americans somewhat incapable of learning from the past or from anywhere else in the world, but I assume that this audience is a bit different. So there's some lessons there based on what's happening to you now, which has happened to us before. So post-independence, you may have noticed that a lot of countries in the world, a lot of young democracies went through a lot of conflict, a lot of struggle. And I think Americans looked at them and said, oh, look at those shitholes. They're like bad people. But now you're going through it yourselves, almost on the same schedule. So you guys have Make America Great Again. In 1948, we had Sinhala First. I'm Sinhalese. And that prioritized my race over other races. And this happened all over the world. In Malaysia, there's the Bhumiputra policy. In India, the BJP is doing it now with Hindutva. This, what you're going through now is not necessarily new. And I think this is somewhat almost a characteristic of democracy. The majority figures out that they can use race or whatever it is to sort of game the whole system and take over and get all the stuff for themselves. And it's not like, I mean, I think races are bad people, but it's not just that they're bad people. This is also a rational political act, which many other democracies have done as well, including mine. And being on, I guess, being your elder, I suppose, being on the other end of it, I would say don't go this way. It does not end well. Race politics, I think, it's like the crystal meth of politics. Like, it gets you high really fast, but then pretty soon your teeth fall out. And we got thrown into 30 years of war, which it started when I was a baby and it continued until I was an adult. And that was just an insane waste of life and time. And we're still fairly traumatized by it. And I can see you guys heading down the same path. And I think a lot of people would warn you this. And I would say resist now while you can. You know, later resistance gets more costly. People get killed. I would say resist peacefully while you can, because the costs long term are much more than you can bear. So I'll talk more directly about what's exactly happening to you right now, which is your coup attempt. I know that Americans don't like, there's this almost phobia of using words, right? Like the word fascism, like, oh no, we can't use that. We might like offend dead Nazis. Or we can't use the word coup, we might like, what is the cost to using these words? The point of these words is to spur you into action against something which has tremendous long-term consequences. And as an outside observer, I don't know what else you call something where the president does not accept the results of an election and takes control of the military. That's a coup. And you need to resist it accordingly. So what happened in Sri Lanka is our minority party working with the president took over the parliament. And they threw chili powder and they threw chairs and they threw books at people. And it was a damn mess. And it lasted for 7 weeks and we were in the streets protesting. And then based on the courts being able to count, you know, a majority in parliament, just as I assume your electors can count a majority of your stupid electoral college, they overturned that coup. And then we were like, oh, cool, we won. And then we essentially went home. We put the same dumbass parliament back and they just like got their cars and their privileges and they went about it. And what I would like to tell you is, I know you're resisting now. My sort of severe warning for you is you must continue resisting. If you don't continue and prosecute these people, as countries like South Korea have done, they will keep coming back. There's a line in The Sopranos where Robert De Niro is talking about Nicky, and he says, you know, if you beat him, he'll come back with a bat. If you come with a knife, he'll come with a gun. If you come with a gun, you better kill him because he'll just keep coming back. And you must understand that this is your Republican Party. They are like Nicky Santoro in the casino. They are crazy and they will keep coming back. And you must resist them. And South Korea, I think, stupid dog, hold on. I'll keep talking. South Korea has shown this because South Korea has prosecuted all of its living ex-presidents. So it is possible to hold elites accountable. And you must hold elites accountable because I would tell you, based on my experience, they keep coming back. I'm sorry, I left. The dog is a neoliberal and a maniac. You must hold them accountable. Otherwise, I'm telling you what happened in Sri Lanka is those guys, once the coup failed, they stopped screaming.
Coup failed, we can hear you.
And they sort of like, and they're actually in power now. They came back. So what they did is what the Republicans are going to do to you is they're going to set your system on fire and they're gonna say, oh, look, it's on fire. You need a change of government. Vote for us. And that's exactly how they come back. And so you must like keep resisting, but you must resist the complacency to say, oh, good, we got Trump out, like it's all over. I swear to God, it's not over. For us, it was a generational struggle. As in, I was a baby when it started. As in, I'm not, like if I'm a time traveler, I'm not you, I'm your children. You have to think about your children because that's how long this struggle will take. And I'm telling you because America is not exceptional, because you're actually behind us in the timeline. And this is the struggle that Sri Lanka and many other young democracies have gone through. So I would recommend, as you go forward, you need international solidarity. So I would seek out voices around you, like talk to your doctors, your professors, your cab drivers, the people cleaning up after you, the people making your food. Like talk to these people. They have information that can really help your lives. And I would say reach out for different voices online, which is possible now because hell, we're like all, you know, a few inches on a screen. I would say reach out to different people because some people are ahead of you in the timeline. And some of this information is very helpful. I would also pay attention to South Korea because Americans seem capable of understanding them because they're rich and they seem to be sort of ahead of you in the timeline. And they're also really aggressive about their democracy. People say they're this like Confucian society, but they overthrow their government and like imprison their leaders all the time. And what they're doing right now is, I think, especially useful for what you have to do, which is you have to prosecute these people, or I swear to God, they will keep coming back.
So thank you, Indy. That was very, we are so glad that we found you and that you were able to come on this international perspective and this idea that we are all connected, these 7 billion people on the planet. What we do here matters to everybody on this planet, and we can learn and we have to learn from people around the world. Next, we're going to hear from Jeff Charlotte. And Jeff Charlotte, again, is the author of The Brilliant Darkness, This Brilliant Darkness and the Family, and a professor of English at Dartmouth College. Jeff, we're so happy that you could join us tonight. I've been following you on Twitter. You've had a lot to say about this coup, so I'm really eager to hear what you're going to be telling our audience tonight.
Yeah, thank you. And I think I want to echo Indy and thank Refuse Fascism and also thank Indy for that essay, which is to me just sort of become one of the definitive pieces of writing about this moment. And so if you haven't read it, you know, stay tuned with us for a little while, but then go first thing right away and read it. I thought I would speak, what I could bring to this is maybe having spent longer than I'd like, almost 2 decades sort of reporting on, among other things, the movement that we now call Christian nationalism. And I thought I would begin with an apology. In 2008, I published a book called The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Plugging it just so you sort of have the context is, you can see there's a Netflix documentary made out of it too, talking about the oldest and arguably most influential Christian nationalist organization in the United States with global impact. And when we talk about how we're connected, I think of Mike Pence, and who Mike Pence first came on my radar through his involvement through this organization and arms deals in Sri Lanka. To look at these American right-wing movements and understand that they are simultaneously provincial and global. But in that book, I had a chapter called the F word, and the F word, of course, is fascism. And I argued that fascism, as it was understood in the European context, which is where most Americans get it from, because they don't realize that there's fascisms all around the globe, that wasn't going to happen in the United States. I didn't say that we were immune from trouble. There's more than one kind of bad under the sun. But I thought that, in fact, what would prevent that from happening would be American fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, which just wasn't going to switch out its idea of divine for the cult of personality, which is sort of a defining feature of classic fascism. I was wrong. And I should have known I was wrong, because this organization was supporting just that kind of fascist cult of personality and regimes around the world. But they had always sort of drawn a line in the United States. Along comes Donald Trump. And, you know, I think I understood most when I was wrong. I was covering a Trump rally in 2016 in Youngstown, Ohio. I was standing with a nice elderly couple, very sweet, kind of older hippies. And the guy started fantasizing about what he would do if he could get his hands on a CNN reporter, and really describing in graphic violence the beating he was going to give him. And his wife was just looking at him with such admiration. And this is the fantasy of the fist. This is the fantasy of the fist that can smash through democratic norms, can smash through truth. Fascism always has to challenge truth. So I recognized I was wrong, and I said, okay, here it is. There's always been authoritarianism and ingrained in American power, but that kind of fascism, cult of personality fascism, is here. What's going to happen with the Christian right and fundamentalism? What are they going to do? Are they really going to switch out Jesus for Trump? The answer is yes, they did. And what I look at as happening is that transaction that we all know, Donald Trump bringing Mike Pence into his campaign. But if you go back and you read Trump's books, and God help me, I have, you understand the so-called art of the deal that he has his ghostwriters write about. A good deal in his vision is transformational of both sides. And so it was for Christian nationalism and Trumpism, which was, it begins like, for your support, I'll give you this, that, and that, the other. But the kind of right-wing populist nationalism that Trump organized embraced the Christian theology of white evangelicalism, and Christian nationalism, in turn, abandoned any vestige of a love ethic, any claim to this is a peaceful idea, and openly and explicitly embraced the idea of a violent God. God's chaos candidate, as they call Trump. So that's what happened. What just happened is we had a great convergence. And while so many people were laughing at Trump's buffoonery and so on, they weren't paying attention to that really potent social movements, including right-wing ones, our coalitions, broad coalitions. This was bringing together so many folks and then using them. I look at QAnon. I've been writing a lot about QAnon lately, that network of conspiracy theories that began with a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., and has now become this sort of global anti-COVID, pro-Kraken. I mean, it's so absurd, you can't even describe it. But there it is. And this idea, it's a fascist theology, and it's infected Christian nationalism. It's given Christian nationalism a way to stay in a kind of forever war. So when I think about that's sort of what just happened, I think, at least from this kind of Christian nationalist perspective, what's to come, I think, is really up in the air. I don't feel any confidence in any prediction. I look at folks who are saying, is this just a grift? Is he planning on running in 24? Is he still looking for ways to seize power? Because I think the prospect of violent coup has diminished, but it's certainly not passed. Things can change. But which is it? What is he really up to? And I think the answer is yes. He's up to all of them. In the same way that this is a convergence of movements, it becomes flexible. And I think we do have to understand that what makes this movement potent and powerful is it's fairly malleable. It can move quickly. So going forward, I think the threats that I see as most disturbing to me, I see two. And I think they can survive with or without Trump. You know, maybe Trump fades away. It doesn't matter. Trumpism will go on. One is this kind of convergence of QAnon and Christian nationalism. The way that this sort of the craziness of the conspiracy theories of QAnon have infected Christian nationalism, but Christian nationalism has given it one of the best organizing machines in the world. How did Trump win in the first time? They turned out to vote like nobody's business. They did get votes. They'll steal things, but they also will get votes. And the other one, and I think it's sort of an interesting thing as we pay attention to the central role of white supremacy and in this movement, I look at what I call police nationalism, which even has its own flag, the Blue Lives Matter flag, an American flag drained of color except for one blue stripe in the middle, created as the creator of the flag told me, he says, I created it as a response to Black Lives Matter. It was created as in many ways, a white supremacist flag. There's a popular meme you may have seen where that one stripe is stripped away and we see behind it the swastika, the Nazi flag. I get the sentiment, it's too easy. The flag is more versatile than that, and that's what makes it more dangerous. And maybe this is sort of where I come in and put a wrinkle in the conversation. We do have a Nazi problem, but we have worse than that. If only it were so simple as Daily Stormer and the Nazis. I think police nationalism is potent because it is such a versatile movement. It allows people to pursue white supremacy, and even as they deny to themselves that they're doing it. It's founded on a fetishization of explicitly brutal police force and implicitly racist idea of policing. And so it's a stabbed in the back flag, to put it shortly, and to sort of borrow from that classic sort of Nazi meme. The police, if only they could do, if their hands were untied, that threat is still there. That threat goes on past whatever happens on January 20th. So what do we do? I sort of cede to my elders in Sri Lanka who have been through this and say, listen to them. Let's pay attention to South Korea and Sri Lanka and the activists and organizers. The one thing that I would contribute to it is I think of a quote from the worst president in U.S. history so far, which is not Donald Trump. It's James Buchanan. I'd argue it's still James Buchanan, 1856 to 1860. He actually got to the Civil War that Trump is almost getting us there. He had one good line when people were saying, you know, they're urging him to impose civility. There was, this is before the Civil War, debate about slavery and so on. And Buchanan, who was rotten in every way, said, nonetheless, he says, I'm not going to crush the conversation. He says, I like the noise of democracy. And the noise of democracy is not harmony. And I think right now we have to resist that temptation. We got rid of Trump. Oh, let's all, we showed that we're better than that. Hell no, we didn't. And it's not a time for unity. I don't think it is. It's a time for cacophony. It's a time for a noise of democracy. And I don't know, I'll hand it over to Andy and Coco, who have more ideas about how to bring that noise, but that's what I want to hear, that noise.
Thank you so much, Jeff. That's a great note to end on. And I think you have one, the way that you pull the lens back and you really look at all of the different forces behind this coalition that came to power is really, I learned so much from it. And I think a very poorly understood aspect and something that never got enough attention in the media was this, well, the Christian fascist or Christian nationalist, the theocratic movement that was, as you said, this organizing machine that brought this regime to power. I forgot to say that you should follow both of these people on social media, on Twitter, at Indica, I-N-D-I-C-A. You can follow Indy, and at Jeff Charlotte. Charlotte is spelled S-H-A-R-L-E-T. And we're going to go to Andy now, who is not really on social media, but you can find his commentary on refusefascism.org and revcom.us, and you can see him every week on the RNL show. So Andy, we're going to hear from you now.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Coco. It's always great to see you. We've been working together these last 4 years remotely, and as we are tonight, and I'm really pleased to have read Indy's piece this week, and now to meet him and that running dog of neoliberalism that he has over there, and for Jeff Charlotte, I appreciate both of what you guys said, and you brought quite a bit to this conversation, which is as important now as it was when we began 4 years ago. So let me start with this. If you've had a recurring nightmare repeatedly jolt you awake, it can be a real problem and indeed dangerous to not find out where that's coming from and then work your way through it. For that source of terror lies deep and it can reassert itself. 4 years ago, as Coco said, Refuse Fascism said, this nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. How prescient that was. How critical the understanding, the analysis, and the still urgent stand of what begins the pledge to the people of the world that we saw earlier in this broadcast from Refuse Fascism that begins with, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. In the name of humanity concentrates the grave danger that a fascist regime in the most powerful imperialist superpower in human history poses, not just to the people here, but to the people of the world and to the very earth that we live on. The Trump-Pence fascist regime came to power through the normal political processes of this system, and the regime represented, it pulled together, it cohered a whole section of the ruling class of this system who regarded and still do this American fascism as one possible resolution to the problems that this system faces in the world today. The Trump-Pence regime did not create the deep divisions in America, nor did it create climate change, nor nuclear weapons, let alone the triad of its fascist program, which Coco spoke of earlier, white supremacy, patriarchy, xenophobia, which is the hatred of foreigners, any more than it created the COVID crisis and the COVID virus. But what the Trump-Pence regime did do is it amplified and it put on steroids all of these pre-existing conditions. And to do so, it concentrated and fought for a different form of rule of this same system. It tore through what had been the political and the civic norms to rule, and here I quote, through reliance on open terror and violence, trampling on what are supposed to be civil and legal rights, wielding the power of the state and mobilizing our organized groups of fanatical thugs to commit atrocities against masses of people, particularly groups of people identified as enemies, undesirables, or dangers to society. All of this to implement their program of America First, an America of genocidal racism, the most toxic male supremacy, and the outright demonization and terrorizing of immigrants in concentration camps, with the children of refugees separated and put into cages as their families fled countries that the US and this capitalist imperialist system has devastated. Isn't this what they have done? And since they are not out of power yet, and 73 million people voted for them, with over 40% of those who voted in this election fervently convinced that Trump won and Biden stole the election and thus is illegitimate, along with their believing in even worse lunatic conspiracy theories, we must remain vigilant now and going forward. This is not going away. There will not be any return to normal, no return to normal. And any objective view of what this country does to millions of people within its borders and to the people of the world and to the planet, no one should want to return to normal for all the horrors that that brings here and around the world. Why? Because fascism, as I said, is one response to the contradictions of this system on the part of a section of those who rule this system. Bob Avakian, the revolutionary leader, has said the normal workings of this system will, quote, continue to wreak havoc on the world and the masses of people through the destruction of the environment, wars, massive displacement and desperation of desperate migration of people, on top of the ongoing savage inequalities, crushing exploitation and murderous oppression written into the DNA of the system and carried out by its enforcers, end quote. This continuing to wreak havoc on the world, quote, comes from an article whose title poses what I hope is a key takeaway from what I'm bringing to our conversation. Radical change is coming. Will it be emancipating or enslaving, revolutionary or reactionary? And I just want to say, for people who are new to tuning this in, I cite Bob Avakian repeatedly and I follow his lead because he has developed the science to more deeply explain where the problems of today's world come from, what the strategy is for getting out of this mess, and what the methods and approaches should be to stay on track and actually build a far better world. The roots of fascism in America are really deep. At the organized mass core of this fascist movement is a Christian fascist movement, what Jeff called the Christian nationalist movement, a form of political Christian fundamentalism that has been organizing for decades. And one can draw a direct line from the fascism of the Trump-Pence regime with this Christian fundamentalist base to the Confederacy. A religious fervor of a return to the lost cause of a noble way of life, of unfettered, brutal white supremacy and patriarchy, each taking on genocidal proportions while wrapped in the MAGA American First package, an aggressive approach to the world, threatening nuclear annihilation that mirrors the aggressive individualism of their movement. My freedom means you might die, as they are fully aware that COVID disproportionately means Black and Latino lives. So I want to bring this to conclusion with 4 points. Number one, there can be no reconciliation with fascism. Trump did not divide us, and Biden cannot unite us. Bob Avakian has pointed out that the minds of these fascists in power in the streets will not be changed by being nice to them. There can be no reconciliation with these fascists, whose grievances are based on fanatical resentment against any limitation on white supremacy, male supremacy, xenophobia, the hatred of foreigners, rabid American chauvinism, and the unrestrained plundering of the environment. And these are increasingly expressed in literally lunatic terms. There can be no reconciliation with this other than on the terms of the fascists, with all the terrible implications and consequences of that, end quote. No reconciliation with this other than on the terms of these fascists. If you compromise, if you conciliate, if you collaborate with fascism, which is what the Democrats have done and will do because they fundamentally represent the same system that has white supremacy, patriarchy, and the domination of the people of the world woven into its very functioning. It is the fuel of the engine of capitalism imperialism. So this is my second point, or it brings me to my second point. And to underscore it, number two, Biden and the Democratic Party, as representatives of the same system, cannot solve the underlying problems of this system, which cause so much unnecessary suffering to people here and around the world. A world of tens of hundreds of millions of refugees, of 150 million children locked in virtual slave child labor, of half of humanity, women confined and thwarted by a vicious patriarchy, of wars, of climate devastation, of racial and national oppression, and the crushing of spirits, and the squandering of human potential to the dictates of a system whose lifeblood is the exploitation of literally billions of people enforced through the brute power and reinforced through tradition's chains. Point three, the contention at the top of this society around the fascist Republican Party that runs deep into the institutions of this country is now in control of the Supreme Court. And after 4 years, it has forged and cohered a hardened fascist base that is not going away, but will continue to metastasize and contend for power. The struggle for any fundamental change in this society, and actually the ground for revolution, will be fought on this ground. It is a conflict that is likely to intensify. And it will be, as Bob Avakian has written, quote, a significant factor in the context of an all-out struggle between revolution and counter-revolution. Point four is there is a way to understand the nightmare of fascism and the workings of the system that gave rise to it. And there is a way for humanity to move beyond a system that perpetuates such unnecessary suffering. To get there requires the scientific method and approach of the new communism developed by Avakian, which stands in opposition to religious obscurantism, to conspiratorial lunacy, as well as to the relativism of the progressive community, that there are just individual truths or truths for different groups, but no objective, knowable reality. So look, there is a road, it's a hard road, towards an actual revolution to a radically new society on the road to real emancipation. And this is outlined in a constitution for a new socialist republic authored by Bob Avakian. So here I am issuing an invitation to take up this scientific approach of the new communism and for people to have the integrity and the courage of thinking critically, to not be bound by the conventions and what's popular today, but to aspire to understand what really could be a radically different and far better world for all of humanity. But the fight against fascism is not over. It is entering a new phase. But let's undertake this fight. Let's continue to fight together against fascism and indeed all the injustices that this system continually brings down on the people. And let's do so while digging into and discussing and debating the way out of all the outmoded madness that haunts the whole planet today. The Refuse Fascism pledge to the people of the world in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America, must continue to resonate far and wide and become not only a needed political and moral compass, but the organized expression of a network ready to act with nonviolent determination to not allow fascism to grow, innate, and terrorize humanity. And the next 50 plus days until Trump and Pence are actually gone from power do represent real and present danger. We must remain vigilant, and we must be ready to act. So to all who have taken up the call from refusefascism.org and to both of my fellow panelists and to you, Coco, all who have exposed the dangers of what we face, until Trump and Pence are gone, we should continue, as the pledge concludes, to hold firm to our determination to prevail over a regime that imperils the people of the world and the earth itself. And so with that, I want to thank you, Jeff and Indy, for joining Coco and myself in this broadcast of taking a look at what has happened over these past 4 years and these past few weeks and what's to come. So Coco, take it away.
Thank you, Andy. You know, what you've just heard is three very thoughtful people discussing this topic. What just happened? Trump, America and the Danger of Fascism. From very different perspectives, there was a lot of unity in what they all said, and there were also differences.
Watch and share the full forum at refusefascism.org. The next forum, why did almost 74 million vote for Trump? And what do we do about this? Will take place on Tuesday, December 8th at 8 p.m. on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook at Refuse Fascism. Next, I talk with my friend and organizer with Refuse Fascism, Deborah Sweet. We are rapidly approaching the 50th anniversary of when Deborah confronted Richard Nixon. It was December 3rd, 1970. Deborah was 19 years old when she was invited to Washington, D.C. from her home in Madison, Wisconsin. She was invited to receive the Young American Medal for Service for her role in organizing the Walk for Development in 1968, which raised $200,000 for the Freedom Farm Co-op in Mississippi, founded by Fannie Lou Hamer. Upon receiving their award, she told Nixon that he was responsible for killing millions of people in Southeast Asia. I chat with her about this anniversary and the lessons for today. Deborah, when you first heard you were getting this award, what were you thinking?
Oh, hell no. There's no way I'm going to take an award from a war criminal. Impossible. I first heard about it just about a month after the invasion of Cambodia, which was in late April of 1970. I got a letter from the White House in early June of 1970 saying I had been chosen to get this award from all the young Americans in the country. It was a medal for service. And it was tremendously embarrassing to me that for what I saw as radical activity in the name of justice for the people of the world, I was going to be given an award by a war criminal. So I was definitely, I am not going. No way. I'm not doing it. I was insulted.
What made you change your mind?
Well,
to decide to go.
Yeah, it was a very strange summer because I heard about it in June and they were like, well, we're going to send a plane for you sometime this summer. And it kept being postponed and postponed and postponed. And during that time, I suppose I, like everyone else, was understanding what a crisis was unfolding after the invasion of Cambodia in particular. The campus where I had attended a year of college shut down in May 1970. It was a very conservative place. You can imagine what it was like across the country at Berkeley and Ann Arbor and the University of Chicago and Columbia, all the places where the student movement was centered. More than 400 schools shut down, and college students were kind of on the loose that summer, trying to figure out what is our responsibility? How can we tolerate what happened in Cambodia and then Canton Jackson State? So all of that was percolating within me. And in the meantime, I traveled the world and the country a little bit, and I met more radical people, including people from the Revolutionary Union, which was the forerunner of the Revolutionary Communist Party, formed around that time. And I really began to get a much more serious understanding, even just a little bit, of the idea of revolution as a solution, and that the complete setup was intolerable. It was never going to lead to justice. Indeed, it never has. I also became a more conscious internationalist. So I kept putting off deciding what I was going to do, except that I felt maybe it was an opportunity. I didn't really know for what. I was incredibly nervous about it and embarrassed and upset. But then my family said, well, it is the president. Not everybody gets to see the president. Maybe we should go. And of course, they were all invited along. So it was kind of a big deal.
Do you remember when exactly you decided what it was you were going to say?
A couple of minutes before I said it. It was a very, very strange interlude. My family and my boyfriend at the time were flown to DC and put up in a hotel and moved around by chauffeur. And we had an appointment at the White House, but the chauffeured limousine took us underground into a building, and we came up on a private elevator. And the private elevator in the Justice Department went into the office of the Attorney General, who was then John Mitchell, later who went to prison for Watergate. But this was actually December 3rd, 1970, and we were brought into this office, and there was John Mitchell, and I was like to my boyfriend, what are we doing here? This man killed Fred Hampton and Mark Clark exactly a year ago tomorrow. Get me the hell out of here. What are we doing here? And then to make it even stranger, this old doddering senile man walks in, and it's J. Edgar Hoover. He walks into the same room where we are and greets us. And I was completely, I'm sure I was completely shut down. I felt like I'm the biggest traitor to justice in the world for even being in this room. It was very difficult. But here's what saved me. This is the thing that happened. Then we get back in the limousine. We're driven to the White House. We go in the Blue Room, and the Blue Room is jammed with press. It was worse than standing room only. People were squeezed in there. And of course, I'm 19. I don't know really what the hell is going on, but I figure this is the way it is at the White House. I don't know. The other young people getting the award, there was three others, were lined up, and Nixon comes in and he gives a speech about, oh, these are the good youth. These are not the ones that are out protesting. They're the ones that love America. And I still didn't know what I was going to say. I had no plan to make a big statement. And actually, I didn't say, Mr. President. When he came to me, I was the last of four people getting the award. And I said, I really don't think you're sincere about giving this award, given that you're responsible for killing millions of people in Vietnam. And you can see my look in a lot of the newspaper coverage of that day. I was really disgusted. And I think he did take my hand. We don't really remember. But when I said that, whatever he did, he dropped it quickly. He looked at his watch and he said, I have an appointment. And he stormed out of the room, which was the main reason that the press knew something had happened. Although some of them heard me say Vietnam and they were like, oh shit, this is important. But the reason all the media was there, which it took me a while to put this together, from the invasion of Cambodia in late April of 1970 to that day, December 3rd, Nixon had held no press conferences. He just boycotted the press. So they had no chance to talk to him. And they came in thinking, maybe we'll get to talk to the president. We'll get to shout questions as soon as he's done with this pro forma, stupid little ceremony that he's doing. And that changed things too, because the story became that he stalked out and he was embarrassed. It still took me a lot of years to feel okay about having gotten this award. But I think that the fact that it was the number one story on the news that night in the US and internationally, it became a story of somebody who got to the president and told him no around Vietnam from inside the empire. That became really important. And I do think it was a significant act on the level of what Eartha Kitt did to LBJ in the 60s and a few other people that have gotten that close to unexpectedly deliver a critical, challenging message. It would be good if more people could do that.
What lessons did you learn through that experience?
The main fact is that millions of people were exactly like me. Millions and millions of people had turned against the war at that point, after years and years, and huge mass struggles, the uprising of Black people that turned the civil rights movement into the movement for Black power, the rise of the women's movement, which I was somewhat but barely aware of, the Native American people. There was a real change in the society from 1960 to 1970, where people were not going to accept the status quo and were looking for mass ways to challenge it. A whole different culture, or a whole feeling of what they're doing is wrong and we're not going to put up with it anymore. And that was buoying me up and giving me a sense of the ethos, even though materially I didn't really very deeply understand what was going on. I did not understand the roots of the Vietnam War and all the history, but I knew what was right. I could speak to that.
I think that one of the lessons that I take away from it as somebody who
was not alive at that time, wasn't around, is that the role that one person's courage can make. The fact that you were able in that moment to take the sentiments that so many had and had a platform in which to speak for the people of the world, and that you seize that opportunity, I can only imagine that the heart that it gave to so many and the courage that it gave to other young people to be raising their voice and to continue raising the voice the way that they had been in the street. So I think that that's a lesson that persists through today. We're days away from this anniversary, 50 years. And I just wanted to close by saying, what do you see the applications of that kind of action today? And how are you marking this anniversary?
It was a time that's not unlike right now in a certain kind of way. It was very polarized. When I'm saying that millions of people were against the war in Vietnam, that is against a backdrop that tens of millions of people were for it. We're sucked into this whole America first. We're fighting communism. If we don't stop them, they're going to come here. All of this bullshit that people were sold by, not just Nixon, but the Democrats who started and prosecuted the war. And that was very sharp. I mean, I didn't live at home with my parents anymore, but they received a lot of fan mail, and they received a lot of really vile hate mail and threats. My father was investigated by the government. We were trailed, and they tried to intimidate us in the aftermath. And it actually pales in comparison with the polarization now. The polarization now that we're seeing is real open fascism at the levels of running the government, and a fascist base that is much more energized, armed, and dangerous, and vocal, and has the airwaves than it was then. And it's a very, very sharp situation. We still need people to go in the face of all of this and tell the truth. That's the biggest weapon we have, is that we do have some answers, that what they're doing is wrong. And I believe we could run society in a much different way. That is why I've continued and tried to develop as a revolutionary communist. The person that I've learned the most from in that regard is Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, who really has formed a constitution for a new society. And I think for many, many people is pointing the way forward. And I really want to foster that as well. So the organization that you, full disclosure, you and I talk every single day about building this movement in the name of humanity to refuse a fascist America. And I want to support that. And I'm going to call on people who remember this incident or have just heard about it or have known me all those years to donate to both Refuse Fascism, because we are putting together a network to refuse fascism in this country, no matter who the president is. And we are vigilant and on the alert right now in December of 2020 for what could still develop. This Trump and Pence have to get out. And even after they do, this fascist movement has to be stopped. So I'm going to be asking people to donate to Refuse Fascism and to the RNL show, which stands for Revolution Nothing Less. It's a show that's on YouTube every week, and also a show that I get a great deal out of and really want to ask people to support. I guess also very important is, if you have a chance to speak truth and to go up against the prevailing atmosphere, whether it's to go back to sleep when your fellow human beings are slaughtered, detained, locked up, or it is just a failure to really even look at that and grapple with it, you have a responsibility to speak out, and you should try to find your voice. And I would say, thankfully, the reactionaries and fascists always provide you a lot of fodder. So no matter how concerned, worried, scared you are that you're going to look the fool, it is very easy to make them look the fool if you just tell the truth.
Well, thank you very much, Deborah. People can check out in the show notes for how to give and honor this anniversary and continue to speak truth to power. Thanks for listening to Inside Without Now. Be sure to subscribe for the latest, and please rate and review this show to help us reach more listeners. Giving Tuesday is only days away,
please give generously in support of Forums, this podcast, and most importantly, protests making good on the pledge to the people of the world to refuse to accept a fascist America. You can give by clicking the donate button at refusefascism.org or Venmo, refuse-fascism, Cash App, Refuse Fascism. Be sure to check the show notes this week to enter the raffle for a collection of artistic pins by Cyber Emeritus. Get your ticket today for only $5. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. Trump Pence, out now. See you in the streets.